Conservatives, liberals, independents, welcome to Both Sides Now, where we sharpen differences or try to bridge them. I'm your host, Mark Green, from WOR 710 AM here in downtown Manhattan, and with prominent voices from both sides of the aisle and spanning America to prove it. From his home in Seattle is MSNBC contributor Ron Reagan, author of the best-selling My Father at 100, and with Arianna Huffington and Elliot Spitzer, a regular. Thanks. Welcome back, Ron.
Glad to be here, Mark.
And from her home in New Orleans is Mary Madeline, CNN contributor, former top aide in the Bush-Cheney administration. Hola, Mary.
Happy holidays.
Okay, she's going to stay radio show. Forget Carnegie Hall. Look, it's been an amazing end of the year as Liz Taylor's estate sold her jewelry for $115 million, which coincidentally is precisely what Mary's diamonds are worth.
In whose world? Did James tell you to say that?
As our last show this year, we'll focus on two huge, imminent issues. All combat troops out of Iraq, and the first votes for president will be cast in Iowa. The presidential race reminds me of Winter Olympic speed skating. Remember, they lope around the rink, all packed together, and then there's a wild sprint to the tape. The sprint's begun. Mitt Romney and Newt Gingrich are now elbowing each other pretty good. Here's the former governor addressing Gingrich in the prior debate on the issue of whether Palestinians are an invented people.
I'm not a bomb thrower, rhetorically or literally.
And then to the New York Times, here's the governor commenting on the former speaker.
Zany is not what we need in a president. Zany is great in a campaign. It's great on talk radio. It's great in the print. Makes for fun reading. But in terms of a president, we need a leader. A leader needs to be someone of sobriety and stability and patience and temperance to think through issues, to be careful in the choice of words he or she might express, because the world listens.
Ron, goodbye 11th Amendment. What's your view of former Governor Romney's attack on former Speaker Gingrich as a zany bomb thrower?
Well, zany is an interesting word to choose. I haven't heard somebody called zany for a while. That's the sort of very Mitt word, I guess.
Ozzie and Harriet.
Ozzie and Harriet, yeah. But, I think that that he may indeed prove to be a zany as time goes on here. He's been zany in the past. But interestingly enough, in last night's Fox News debate, Mitt seemed to pull back and let his advertising do the speaking for him and didn't really go after Newt Gingrich face to face. I'm not sure if he just that was a strategic move, tactical move, whatever, or if he's actually chicken and didn't want to, mix it up with Newt on national television.
Well, welcome to being a front runner, Mary. Is it just inside baseball or important that leading conservative commentators have hit Gingrich as too hot-headed to be president? Now, we're talking about Noonan and Will and Podhoretz and Brooks and the Washington Exam and the National Review warned against, quote, their words, a hasty marriage Republicans would regret. That's a hell of a metaphor for Gingrich. Why are they all doing this? Is it important?
Yes, it is important. And it's illustrative, and I'm not the first to note this, but the people who know Newt best, have worked closest with him, were the most critical, including and more damaging than all of the aforementioned, were his former congressional colleagues and mild-mannered ones. That hurt Newt. He didn't make any mistakes, but this was the best week ever for Romney, setting aside calling zany. I like that word. I didn't like it at first. I don't like the ad hominem attacks, but I like the word now that the way you said it, Ron, zany. It is. It does have a kind of Ozzie and Harriet thing. But it was strategic, and it was deftly executed to do that all week and then pull back, get above the fray in the debate, and let the other guys do the smash mouth stuff. And without falling prey to what took Pawlenty out, which is looking weak.
How did Gingrich handle the assault? Because it really came from, conveniently for Romney, from Ron Paul and Michelle Bachmann.
You know, he handles these things pretty well, actually. I have to say, I'm no big Newt Gingrich fan by any means, but he seems to keep his cool and bat the things away. And we already see also that he seems, in some polls at least, to be peaking and heading downwards. So maybe, the more you know Newt, the less you like him.
Let's move beyond that, because who knows? let's talk about the merits of the charges, that he's just too much of a bomb thrower. I remember him, Mary, blaming Democrats when this wacky Susan Smith killed her children. Then there was, of course, the government shutdown, impeachment, replacing janitors with child laborers a month ago. And let's listen to what he said at the Fox debate Thursday night.
The courts have become grotesquely dictatorial, far too powerful, and now, and I think, frankly, arrogant in their misreading of the American people. We have a balance of three branches. We do not have a judicial dictatorship in this country, and that's what the Federalist Papers promised us. And I would, just like Jefferson, Jackson, Lincoln, and FDR, I would be prepared to take on the judiciary if, in fact, it did not restrict itself in what it was doing.
What of the former attorneys general? These are conservative former attorneys generals who have criticized the plan, as I say, dangerous, ridiculous, outrageous, yes, totally irresponsible.
That was Megyn Kelly, who is a lawyer on from Fox. Ron, Goldwater and Reagan were attacked by Democrats as being too hot for the presidency. So Ron Reagan, objectively, is is Gingrich more like Goldwater, who lost big, or Reagan?
Well, I don't think he's really like either one of them, but I think he's going to get himself in trouble here because, you know, some of these things, as you heard from the audience reaction, some of these things like attacks on the judiciary will go over very big in a Republican room. However, when you get into the general election and people start really examining a position like, let's haul justices up before Congress and, you know, see if we can kind of beat them up and then impeach them for doing things that we as Republicans just don't like, then you get into some real problems here. And that's not, I think Megyn Kelly was absolutely right. That's going to be a problem in the general election
by the way,
if he makes it that far.
I think the bigger picture is Newt a bomb thrower? Does he say zany things? Whatever, however you want to express that. That was once his strength. And it is not a weakness except in, because he's so articulate and he's so deep and he's so historical. It's only a weakness insofar as he can't calibrate per application, if that makes sense.
Look, there's a second line of attack in all the debates and the ads, which is about money-making, buck-raking. Let's listen first to Mitt Romney, who was much chided for this response to Rick Perry.
I'll tell you what. $10,000? $10,000 bet?
I'm not in the betting business,
but I'll show you.
All right. More important, though, is what Mitt Romney said thought out about Newt Gingrich and Freddie Mac and money.
Do you believe he's a lobbyist, really? And do you believe that since he took money of Fannie and Freddie, the defunct, pretty much hated agencies now, do you believe he should give that money back?
Well, I sure do. He was in the business of connecting folks with government. He was on K Street. One of the things that I think people recognize in Washington is that people go there to serve the people, and then they stay there to serve themselves.
Newt hit back.
I would just say that if Governor Romney would like to give back all the money he's earned from bankrupting companies and laying off employees over his years at Bain, that I would be glad to then listen to him. And I'll bet you $10, not $10,000, that he won't take the offer.
Mary, Rush Limbaugh was really upset that they each sounded like Occupy Wall Street attacking the other for money, which is ironic and interesting. Who do you think got the best of that much-covered exchange?
Romney, because Rush is right about Newt did sound like one of you guys. Like, it's okay to go into the private sector and be an entrepreneur and take risks and be successful and sometimes not. That was Romney's finest moment in the debate when he compared the world, the real world in which Obama doesn't live, and what he did with GM and his own private experience with Bain Capital, etc. So Newt was really off there, but prior to that, it was double off because that 10K bet was the worst soundbite of the week until Newt stepped on that. So I think Romney won that one.
We're going to come back and conclude on Mitt Romney as a very successful businessman, and we'll come back to ask what the surprise in Iowa could be and whether the GOP is more extreme than mainstream, according to a Bush speechwriter. And why are so fewer of us getting married? Only on Both Sides Now. Welcome back. I'm Mark Green, host of Your Views on the News Weekend, Both Sides Now. We're sponsored by the American Federation of Teachers, making a difference in the lives of children every day. And if you want to make a comment or a criticism, please contact us at BothSidesRadio@gmail.com. That's BothSidesRadio@gmail.com. I'm here with Mary Madeline of CNN and Threshold Editions and Ron Reagan of MSNBC on the Iowa vote. And whether Romney-Gingrich will end up being one of the great rivalries, Yankees-Boston, Obama-Clinton, or peter out. Mary, I want to ask you about Romney. He has been so successful in the private sector. I mean, this is not ideological. This is mathematical. He made $250 million. Very smart guy. Is that obvious money and success? And a big plus for him in the primaries because he is the embodiment of a successful businessman. Or is he Mr. 1%? He's kind of like the rich kid next door.
Except the more we get to know him, the more I like him in this way that he was born to wealth, but he lived a Spartan life. And part of it's the Mormon missionary business. Part of it's the parental guidance in that way. And some, I don't know where this piece just appeared, but he's rich, but Spartan. He's frugal. He's really a spendthrift. So he has the right values.
I think the more we see of Mitt Romney, the less a lot of people like him. And in fact, people just don't like Mitt Romney, and that's his problem. He can't get above 25%, and that's why, you know, the Republican Party is riffling through all these other candidates, trying to try one on that would seem to fit. He is apparently somewhat frugal in his personal life, but frugal in a really, really rich guy kind of way. And that $10,000 bet, well, it was a minor thing, and I don't make too much of it, I think is an example of that. Most people don't have $10,000
right
to throw around.
You just hit the nail on the head. It's not that he has hubris or he is missing humility. He's just a dork, okay? He can't pull off this, like, regular guy bet thing. He needs to embrace his dorkness because there is a lovable side of him, but somebody keeps trying to make him into a cowboy or something that he isn't.
Ron, is the GOP problem not so much as candidates, but it's voters? A Bush speechwriter, David Frum, wrote a very controversial piece in New York Magazine saying that his party, he thought, was out on a right wing and a prayer on taxes on the rich, death panels, climate. Mm-hmm. And a Pew poll this week asking which party was more extreme. Mm-hmm. Independents said the GOP was more extreme, 54 to 30%. Mm-hmm. What do you think about the Frum thesis in the Pew poll?
Well, I think David is onto something, David Frum. I mean, listen, the GOP, since the 1960s, since the civil rights era, really has employed a Southern strategy, which started off as being implicitly race-based, but has now broadened out to become ignorance-based. You know, they have cultivated the ignorant and ignorance itself through venues like Fox News. But, you know, polls have now shown several times that people who watch Fox News, the Republican station, as it were, know less about the world than people who watch no news at all, because it's a propaganda outfit. They're actually misleading people and telling them to believe things that are just nonsense, like global warming is a big giant global hoax.
Now, Mary has a different point of view, clearly. But Mary, what about the reality that the Tea Party simply won't let these candidates be more factual and scientific on some of these issues?
One, Frum is not a conservative. He has never been a conservative. He doesn't speak for conservatives. Two, it is not the party of ignorance. It is the party of success. And if there's anybody more ignorant than some Democratic Congress people, I don't know where it is, and I haven't seen it.
Let's listen to Barack Obama on 60 Minutes this week. Sounded like he was itching to run, not against a particular person, but a particular ideology.
Well, I mean, you're being judged now on your performance.
No. I'm being judged against the ideal. And you know, Joe Biden has a good expression. He says, don't judge me against the Almighty. Judge me against the alternative. So it doesn't really matter who the nominee is going to be. The core philosophy that they're expressing is the same. And the contrast in visions between where I want to take the country and where they say they want to take the country is going to be stark.
Rush Limbaugh had a very different point of view, obviously, about moderation and conservatism in the party on Greta Van Susteren.
The Republican establishment has decided they don't want any part of conservatism. They believe what the inside the Beltway philosophy is about conservatives. They're racist, sexist, bigot, homophobe, southern hayseed hicks. They're pro-lifers. They're embarrassing to have to go to convention with them.
Here are people who are running for president. Rick Santorum said that Obamacare reminded him of Mussolini's Italy. Rick Perry in his ad said that Obama had a war on religion. Do you at all worry that stuff like this could hurt, let's say, Romney, were he the nominee?
No. Why would anything that Santorum or Perry said hurt Romney? They're speaking to a specific audience in the way that the kinds of things that the Democrats said in their last primary just were fingernails on a blackboard to me. They were preaching to their choir. All of this is white noise to a general electorate.
Ron, the Pew poll. Is Mary right that Romney's not going to be shackled by this?
I think it will turn off swing voters. You know, Rick Perry's comment, for instance, in his ad about, you know, while gay people, I'm paraphrasing, but while gay people can serve in the military, you know, kids can't pray in school. This is an example of what I was talking about. And I don't mean to be name calling here, but that is simply an ignorant statement. Anybody can pray anywhere at any time. This is a false issue that he raises there, and the GOP does this all the time, and it's not helping them in the long run.
It's not a false issue for a segment of the primary electorate.
But it is a false issue in fact, Mary. Kids can pray in school anytime they want, can't they?
It is the language of a segment of that electorate. The religious right, it is shorthand for a much bigger and different articulation, you're right, than the general electorate would hear it. But that's shorthand for what they believe, and he could take through the issues. And it is the centerpiece of the attraction for a Perry candidacy because the evangelical religious right is such an important and sizable block in the Iowa caucuses.
I will be right back to talk about Iraq after the withdrawal and who would win. Oh, we love it. An Obama-Gingrich debate. Talk about both sides. Welcome back. I'm Mark Green, host of Both Sides Now, which is sponsored by the American Federation of Teachers. We're with Mary Madeline and Ron Reagan. 8 years ago, who doesn't remember this?
My fellow citizens, at this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq, to free its people, and to defend the world from grave danger.
This week, President Obama spoke to returning soldiers at the war's end.
And on behalf of a grateful nation, I'm proud to finally say these two words, and I know your families agree. Welcome home. Welcome home. Welcome home. It's harder to end a war than begin one. Now, Iraq's not a perfect place. It has many challenges ahead. But we're leaving behind a sovereign, stable, and self-reliant Iraq with a representative government that was elected by its people.
And here in a later press conference is President Obama handling the very ticklish issue of commenting on a war that he always opposed and then ended up concluding.
I also wonder if on this occasion you still think of this as a dumb war.
Yeah, I think history will judge the original decision to go into Iraq.
Ron, could you tell us what you think the benefits, just the benefits, and there were some, of the invasion, occupation, and the eight-year war of Iraq were?
In either 1988 or 89, I always forget which, I made a phone call to the then president of the United States. This was after Saddam Hussein had gassed the Kurdish citizens up in the north of his country. And I proposed to the president that he go to the UN and try and assemble a international coalition to remove Saddam Hussein from power on the basis of him having committed genocidal acts. It was explained to me that Saddam Hussein was a useful bulwark against Iran, and so that probably wasn't going to happen. 10 years or so later, more than 10 years later, when it was decided that we should go into Iraq, I thought it was too late for that. That the statute of limitations, in a sense, had almost passed. But I have to say that if there is one good thing about the invasion and occupation of Iraq, it is that Saddam Hussein is no longer in charge of that country.
And what about the benefits of there is compared to then, obviously a kind of roughly working democracy. And while he didn't have WMD, obviously. Mm-hmm. This government cannot and will not start up a program like that. Those are benefits too, right?
That is a benefit. It is a sort of democracy there. I mean, we'll see how well their democracy fares.
Mary, what do you think the costs 8 years later, both in money, personnel, and opinion and policy have been?
Well, loss of life is incalculable, so let's just set that off. I think the loss of having an honest dialogue and debate on foreign affairs and national security, which used to be the norm in politics, stopped at the water's edge. We have lost that in the last decade or so, and that is the greatest loss, because what Ron just said there, the essential point that his father and he just made, is the necessity, which is greater today than it was even then, of having a bulwark against Iran.
What about like fury on the Arab street because after Abu Ghraib and all the accusations of Guantanamo? Now, looking back, in hindsight, was it worth it?
Yes, on what Ron said and other things, but I don't count that the outrage as a cost, because the outrage pre-existed that. They already hated us. That's why there was a 9/11, and they don't like us anymore, even though they have the most pro-Arab Street president sitting in the Oval Office as we speak. So that cost was discounted. We didn't create that problem. We might have, they might can use that as an excuse, but they already didn't like us, so I don't count that.
Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo, there's no consequence to that in terms of world opinion or more Islamic jihadists getting mad at us. Ron?
We sullied our international reputation severely. We now have a gulag of prisons set up around the world in Central Asia where we keep people, you know, incommunicado and, you know, forever if we want to, I suppose. And, of course, we tortured people. And that, more than anything, committing war crimes during this was something that I don't know how you regain your stature after doing something like that, and that was one of the real costs to this.
There's another criticism of Obama that is made most prominently and forcefully. First, let's listen to Senator John McCain on the pullout at the end of this year, and then former Vice President Dick Cheney.
I believe that history will judge this president's leadership with this scorn and disdain that it deserves.
We're now in a situation where we're pulling all of our troops out of Iraq, period, no stay behind force. He's trying also to accelerate the withdrawal from Afghanistan. I mean, it generally looks like a U.S. withdrawal from the region, and I think it diminishes the U.S. presence, but I think that's a mistake.
Mary, where are you on the issue of whether we should have withdrawn on December 31st, as the original Status of Forces Agreement had indicated, or whether we should have left a large combat presence if Iraq had permitted it?
Well, you're right that this road to a, I think, premature pullout was initiated with the SOFA, the Status of Forces Agreement. But I keep going back to Iran and the instability in the region, which is greater now than it was when we went in. But the point is, it's more unstable today. It's a riper environment for Iran to be a hegemon, which is just so dangerous for the entire world on so many different levels. And to the extent we have no presence there, that's dangerous, literally, and more generally, our reputation for staying power and our a reputation for doing what we say we're going to do, which is finish the job, is who's going to trust us?
But Mary, you're right that Iran's Shia presence has risen in a country that's now Shia since we kicked out the Sunni Hussein. But if we fought, arguably, for a better democracy, and that democracy says leave because they wouldn't guarantee that our soldiers couldn't be arrested, how do we not leave.
That we've had this conversation before. There was a way that behind the scenes diplomacy worked to protect our soldiers, which had been in place. But everybody on the ground there knows, everybody in the State Department knows, that Obama used that as a literal level leverage to do what he wanted to do politically. There was a way to nuance that and massage that, which happens in diplomacy all the time. But I want to say a second point about democracy that we've learned and was a mistake of our era, and it was a bipartisan mistake, which is that all democracies look alike, and that without the infrastructure of democracy, be it private property, rule of law, some sort of cultural heritage, it is not a factor of just holding elections.
I'd like to play an exchange in effect between Romney and Obama that dealt largely with the Middle East that was electrifying. First, Romney before the Jewish Republican Council a week ago.
President Obama has adopted an appeasement strategy. Appeasement betrays a lack of faith in America, in American strength, and in America's future.
Ask Osama bin Laden and the 22 out of 30 top al-Qaeda leaders who've been taken off the field whether I engage in appeasement or whoever's left out there. Ask them about that.
Oh, well, I think Obama did very well in responding to Romney. Appeasement, it was the wrong word to use. I mean, if he wants to take issue with something that Obama has done in the Middle East, he's free to do that. But citing Neville Chamberlain, or seeming to, and appeasing Hitler was going way, way too far there. And exactly, ask bin Laden what he thinks about that.
Mary?
I agree with Ron that that's a loaded word, and not on point applicable, but neither is the taking out of al-Qaeda leadership, which would not have been possible without the policies and programs that Bush put in place. What was more interesting to me about that exchange is the way in which Obama displayed, once again, how thin-skinned he is. Romney's not even anywhere close to being the nominee, and he just has that edge in his voice, which is more demonstrable when you're listening to it. I watched that, but hearing it now again, it's like this guy's going to have a problem with the criticism that's going to come his way in a general election.
Well, he was asked that at a press conference. And so if you're both in agreement that making a Hitler reference and the president is asked about it, I mean, Ron and I would be more hysterical if we were asked that.
I thought Obama. That's why you're not the president.
We all agree.
He should have swatted it off then.
Well, but I think he did. That to me, that was a swat off. It was, you know, ask bin Laden. You know, basically. I mean, it's that saying nonsense. In other words.
Hey, thank you. If that's the first of many exchanges like that, both sides now is going to have a lot to cover. Stay with us for segment four on Quick Takes, on driving without cell phones, and whether schools needing money should prefer potato chips to granola in the vending machines. Only on Both Sides Now. From both sides. I'm living it all. Thanks for staying with us. I'm Mark Green, the host of Both Sides Now, sponsored by the American Federation of Teachers, making a difference in the lives of children every day. We're here with Mary Madeline of CNN and the chief editor at Threshold Editions, and Ron Reagan of MSNBC, author of My Father at 100. And now let's go to Quick Takes, where Ron and Mary give brief answers to questions about hot or interesting topics. First, the National Transportation Board has recommended banning all cell phone use and texting in cars. Here's NBC Nightly News report on it.
Under a new refined reporting system, the government says there were 3,092 fatalities as a result of distracted driving in 2010.
We know that this recommendation is going to be very unpopular with some people, but we're not here to win a popularity contest.
Ron, you, if you had to decide for or against a complete ban, not a handset or hands-free, a ban.
I would vote for the ban. I've driven behind people who are using cell phones in their cars, and believe me, you can tell right away who they are as they drift off, you know, and into the other lanes. Study after study has shown that it's like driving drunk. Absolutely. It's unenforceable, I will say that, but the law should be on the books anyway.
Mary.
Ron, a couple of weeks ago, said something with which I agree, that you should never make legislation for a problem that doesn't exist. And he just hit on what the corollary to that is. You should never make laws you cannot enforce. They should have this ban on mass transit. We should not have it on individuals because you can't enforce it. But there could be an incentive that is greater than a ticket. Now people don't care if they get a ticket. But if there were an accident and it could be proved that it was the result of distraction from one of these handhelds or whatever you want to, whatever the thing is, then you pay 10 times what the ticket would have been, and you pick up the other guy's cost. If you don't incentivize the consequences of this stuff, people are just going to keep taking the tickets.
Yeah, in Britain they actually do that at traffic stops. The cops will check cell phones if they suspect you've been using it. They will. They'll do it, and they'll nail you for it.
Second, the percentage of adults in America who are married has fallen from 3/4 to 1/2 since 1960. That's a big fall. Mary, why? And is this a good, bad, or indifferent trend?
Why? Because marriage is hard. One, very hard. Two, because it's culturally accepted now not to be married. And three, it is really horrible in the sense of what it does for kids. There's all kinds of studies that suggest, unless you can have kids and keep some kind of bond that makes them safe and secure, the upshot of this increased divorce, I see it in my kids' classmates all the time. But I will say marriage is hard, and that's when you're in love, as I am. It's still hard.
Wrong.
Yeah, I've been married for 31 years myself. I don't know that it's just more people getting divorced, although I'm sure that's part of it. It's also people delaying marriage. The average age for marriage now for men, I think, is like 28 years old. And for women, I think 25. So that's a big part of it, I think. And also, I think because people just, Mary's right, it's hard, and people don't like hard anymore. When they when they experience hard, they throw it away and buy a new one.
Third, a Seattle school district has replaced junk food in school vending machines with healthier fare, but then lost some 80% of the revenue it needs from the machines for after-school programs, et cetera. So they're now thinking of going back to the original food. Your view of a healthy food versus potato chips?
My view is that schools are educational institutions, and anything they do should further education, and that includes teaching kids to eat right. So I'm for the granola and not the potato chips.
Mary?
I'm kind of an agnostic on this. I don't like the nanny state part of it, but I also don't like the kind of foods that both my kids do not have an option to in school cafeterias, and they've taken to packing their own lunches. So I think Ron is right. I would like that there was more personal responsibility incentive as opposed to like not giving them the choice to make the right decision.
Last, I don't know what you would say. Look, we would love it, an Obama-Gingrich debate in a general election. Let's stipulate they're both very smart and in their ways very experienced. Mary, who would win that matchup?
It depends what our expectation and definition of victory is going to be at the time. And what it always includes is exceeding expectations. And since they both have such extraordinary expectations, I think it would just end up being a draw. The conservatives and whoever they're for is going to hear what they want to hear, and all sides will declare victory unless one of them really tripped up. And there's no evidence that either of them do not have the discipline to get through a debate.
Ron, before asking you, a lot of it, though, is style. Mm-hmm. We now know, looking back based on polls and word of mouth, that JFK bested Nixon in the debate. Mm-hmm. Reagan bested Carter in the debate. Kerry in polls bested Bush. What about the contrast in style, which was decisive with Kennedy, Nixon?
Yeah, style-wise, I would have to give the edge to Obama. Gingrich, again, and you know, you can say that I'm biased, of course, but Gingrich still, I see the arrogance coming out of him, the self-inflated ego, and I don't see that as much with Obama.
But lots of Americans do, and this has been roundly commented on. The hubris, the arrogance, the condescension, like in some ways, Newt's weakness is his strength. He is kind of a, what is it, Imus calls him a bag of doorknobs, do you know? Like, and I think people are getting kind of sick. Obama can be too cool is all I'm saying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he can at times.
Now let's look at you two, not as candidates or debaters. Your week, Mary, what did you do, public, private realm, that, you know, the audience may learn from and know about?
I just want to say to all the mothers out there, I finished my Christmas shopping, and I'm halfway through all the wrapping. So kudos to me. All handpicked and wonderfully thought through.
I'll text you my address after the show. Ron?
Well, I always enjoy celebrating the solstice, so we went out and cut down a tree. We cut down a tree. It's all decorated, just like the old Attic religion of ancient Europe. We like to bring a tree into the house.
You Wiccan, you.
Yeah. Christmas versus Halloween again. Thank you, Mary Madeline. Thank you, Ron Reagan. Thank you, WOR710, our anchor station of some 120 carrying us around the country. Isn't it better to hear both sides of the story? If it's the weekend, we debate, you decide.